of those accused of the most heinous and despicable acts is a measure by which we mark our adherence to the rule of law. The failure to bring Seal and his co-conspirators to trial in the 1960s was a failure of the rule of law. But while his conviction some 40 years later was well-intentioned, it too was a failure of the rule of law. For decades, officials in Mississippi exploited the death investigation system to whitewash racial violence. In 2007, they exploited it to give an old racist what he deserved. It could be argued that Haynes' assistance in the Seal prosecution was evidence that he was on the side of right. Indeed, many would agree that the state's pursuit of cold civil rights cases is an expiation of sorts. Certainly few would question that Seal finally received some sort of justice, karmic perhaps. But it's also true that prosecutors had to go to Haynes in order to shore up what otherwise was a fatal problem with its forensic evidence. The stakes seemed different. An old, unrepentant racist and a chance for the state to make a name, a good one this time, for itself in an arena that mostly featured failures. But in the final analysis, the state's death investigation system was open to manipulation. Nothing had changed, except the times. Chapter 14. Redemption and Insurrection. Power concedes nothing without a demand. It never did, and it never will. Frederick Douglass. Kenny's a shy guy, says André Degree. He doesn't have a lot of words. Degree speculates that police, prosecutors, or jurors likely mistook that shyness for the cliched quiet loner label often attached to child predators and killers. I think it could have hurt him with a jury, he says. When Forrest Allgood had Brewer's IQ tested, he scored a 65, generally considered borderline mentally disabled. But IQ doesn't always tell the whole story. I remember there was a point after the DNA tests that Allgood had made Kenny a plea offer, says Degree. He still thought Kenny was guilty, so his theory was that there were other people involved in the crime. He made Kenny a deal. If he gave up the names of the other attackers, Allgood would let him out with time served. By then, Brewer had been in prison for over 10 years. Degree took the offer to his client. After Brewer finished listening, he asked Degree, "So all I gotta do is give you a name, and they'll let me walk out?" "That's right," Degree replied. Brewer thought for a moment. "But if I give you a name, they'll do a DNA test on that person, right?" Degree nodded. Brewer said, "So I gotta give you the right names, don't I?" Again, Degree nodded. Brewer paused and then said, "Don't they know that if I knew the right name of the killer, I'd have given it up a long time ago?" Brewer doesn't show a lot of emotion. He rarely gets angry, rarely gets upset. That, too, may have made him look cold to police, prosecutors, and jurors. "I've always said Kenny's mother was angry enough for the both of them," Degree says. "I used to tell Kenny after talking to him, 'Now I'm going to go get yelled at by your mother.' I mean, she wasn't yelling at me. She just needed someone to yell at. But that wasn't Kenny. It just wasn't his way." According to Degree, the closest he saw Brewer come to anger was when he once said of Allgood, "I can see how maybe you screw up a case, but you could at least apologize." Allgood still has never apologized to Brewer. Because Brewer so rarely got emotional, Degree remembers vividly one of the few times he did. It was in 2007. Brewer had been released on bail, but had yet to be formally exonerated. There was still talk of trying him again. New York Times reporter Shayla DeWan had come to Macon to write about Brewer's case. "We were talking to Kenny at his mom's house," Degree recalls. Shayla started asking Kenny about Christine Jackson, the little girl who was killed. And Kenny began to cry. "I guess I just wasn't prepared for that. After all that time, it came out of nowhere. But there it was." He told Shayla that she wasn't his daughter, but he still cared for her. He started talking about how because he had been taken to jail so quickly, he never got to go to her funeral. All these years had gone by, and he still hadn't had a chance to visit her grave. DeGree says that's when he realized something important that he and Brewer's other attorneys had been overlooking. We were so busy trying to get Kenny out of prison, we had never really talked to him about Christine. It hit me that Kenny wasn't just a victim of a wrongful conviction. He was a victim of Justin Johnson, too. He was a victim of this crime just as much as anyone else in that little girl's life. And after all that had happened to him, he never really got the chance to heal. It wasn't just the timing of the emotion that stuck with DeGree, but the impetus for it. Here's a guy who had never gotten angry over being wrongly convicted for killing this little girl, never got angry about being put on death row. The one time he really broke down, it was because he never got to grieve for that little girl. When Brewer's lawyers asked the jury not to execute their client back in 1995, one of their pleas was that the jury allow Brewer to live, to return a sentence of life in prison, so that he might have the chance to someday test the biological evidence in the case. DNA testing, particularly in criminal cases, was at the time a relatively new concept. The technology was still young. Give an opportunity for technology to catch up, Brewer's lawyer pleaded with the jury. If technology confirms your decision, he will remain in prison for the rest of his life. If technology decides that the sperm that were inside that little girl were not his, then he may be released. The jury wasn't persuaded, but despite the best efforts of Governor Kirk Fordyce, the Clarion Ledger editorial board, and a good portion of the Mississippi legislature, Kennedy Brewer did live long enough for the technology to catch up. But two critical, unrelated events separated by more than a decade had to occur for LaVon Brooks and Kennedy Brewer to win their freedom. The first came in the spring of 1983, when Carrie Mullis, a scientist at a California biotech company, was on his way to spend a weekend at his mountain cabin in Mendocino County, 3 hours north of San Francisco. Around mile marker 46 on Highway 128, Mullis had an epiphany. He pulled over and grabbed a pen and paper from the glove compartment. His girlfriend, Jennifer, was sleeping in the seat beside him. She woke up and wondered, somewhat annoyed, why they had pulled over in the middle of nowhere. The drive had gotten Mullis thinking. Specifically, he had been thinking about oligonucleotides. Exactly what he was thinking about them isn't as important as what happened next. Mullis was on his way to discovering a process called polymerase chain reaction, PCR for short. It would revolutionize the field of DNA study, it would win him a Nobel Prize, and it would save the lives of Brooks and Brewer. The second event occurred on June 13, 1994, with the murders of Nicole Brown Simpson and Ron Goldman in Los Angeles. Nicole's ex-husband, former professional football star O.J. Simpson, was eventually arrested and charged with the killings. DNA evidence found at both the crime scene and later at Simpson's house connected him to the murders. Simpson's attorneys reached out to Barry Scheck and Peter Neufeld, two former New York legal aid attorneys who had become leading legal experts in a niche practice area, what they referred to as the intersection between science and the law. This was the newly emerging science of DNA testing. After arriving in California to become part of Simpson's legal team, Scheck and Neufeld brought in Edward Blake, a DNA analyst in Richmond, California, to help with the blood evidence. It was the first of many times that Blake would help the two men exonerate an innocent person. Neufeld would later describe Blake's analytical prowess in baseball terms. "There are a bunch of 300 hitters, and then there's Ted Williams," Neufeld would say. "Ed Blake is Ted Williams." DNA was first used to help solve crimes in the mid-1980s when a British geneticist named Alec Jeffries developed a technique to match a strand of DNA to a specific person. His technique was known as the restriction fragment length polymorphism, or RFLP. But RFLP had some problems. The first was that there had to be a lot of DNA available for an RFLP test to be effective. But even under optimal conditions, the procedure itself was cumbersome. Even with enough blood, it could be difficult to get consistent, conclusive results. Carrie Mullis's side of the road revelation was about a process that would allow scientists to essentially take trace amounts of DNA, or DNA that had degraded, and reconstruct and reproduce it so that it could be analyzed. Ed Blake was a colleague of Mullis's in California. The two men began working with the FBI to explore how PCR could be used to analyze criminal evidence. They debuted their new technique in the late 1980s in Pennsylvania, in a macabre case in which a couple was accused of holding a man captive and starving him to death. From there, PCR revolutionized the field of DNA science and its use in the criminal justice system. DNA testing would soon be used both to add certainty to new convictions and to free hundreds of people who had been wrongly convicted. It would also expose critical flaws in numerous fields of forensics once thought to be foolproof. The primary mission of Brewer's attorneys in New York was to redo the DNA tests on the sperm. Analysis from the lab in New Orleans had cleared Brewer years earlier, but oddly suggested that two other men had raped Christine Jackson. After getting court permission to pursue additional DNA testing in 2007, Brewer's new legal team turned to Ed Blake. Noxubee County law enforcement officials sent several boxes of physical evidence to Blake's lab in California. The lab began by retesting all of the evidence. The state's case began to crumble almost immediately. The police had found fecal material and semen on one of Christine's dresses recovered from the bedroom. Forrest Allgood had claimed at trial that this was evidence of a sexual assault and referred to the bedroom as a killing ground. Blake's tests showed that the material was indeed semen and fecal matter, and the semen was Brewer's. The fecal matter, though, was not from Christine. Instead, it was from Gloria Jackson. This was consistent with Jackson's story. She had used the dress to wipe herself off after she and Brewer finished having sex. For some, that may have been evidence that Jackson and Brewer weren't model parents, but it was not evidence that Brewer had raped Christine Jackson. Blake's lab tested the sperm sample next. It quickly discovered a mistake in the original testing from 2001. While they confirmed that the DNA profiles did not match Kennedy Brewer, Blake discovered that the earlier analysts were wrong to suggest that there were two male contributors. There was only one. Brewer's lawyers were stunned at the news, but also knew they needed more. The state was still determined to try Brewer again. In the 15 or so years of forensic DNA testing to that point, no one who had been excluded by DNA had ever been retried for the same crime. Forrest Allgood's determination was historically unprecedented. Other authorities were just as adamant, if not completely clear on what had happened. Deputy Ernest Eichelberger told the New York Times in 2007 that he hadn't used DNA to investigate and convict Brewer, seemingly suggesting that DNA couldn't therefore exonerate him. While Allgood had tested the DNA profile from the crime against Brewer's two friends and several of his male relatives, he had yet to run it through the state's DNA database of criminal offenders. That seemed odd, given that a match not only might clarify whether Brewer played a role in the crime, but might help apprehend one or even two child rapists and killers. Allgood told the New York Times he had never run the sample through the database because no such database existed in Mississippi. He was wrong. There was a database, and it had been up and running for years. Fortunately for Brewer, by that time Allgood was no longer on the case. In March 2006, Allgood's office had hired one of Brewer's former attorneys. That presented a conflict for Allgood that forced him to remove himself from the case. Ben Creekmore, a district attorney from Northwest Mississippi, took over as special prosecutor. The only way to shake Brewer free from state prosecution once and for all would be to identify Christine Jackson's real killer. Ed Blake figured the most obvious place to start would be with whatever biological evidence might exist within the boxes of material included in the shipment from Noxubee County. When county law enforcement had transported the suspects to a local hospital back in 1992, a nurse swabbed their cheeks and preserved the swabs. Blake went to work on the swabs, extracting DNA profiles from each. After locating and isolating the usable DNA, he began his analyses. It didn't take long for him to match the profile developed from one of the swabs to the sperm found in Christine Jackson. The sperm belonged to Justin Johnson. After 16 years, Christine Jackson's murder was finally solved. The evidence boxes from Noxubee County also included a rape kit from LaVon Brooks's case. Unfortunately for Brooks, what little DNA remained had degraded to the point where even Blake couldn't generate a usable profile. For now, at least, Brooks was out of luck. Brewer's lawyers bypassed Allgood and Noxubee County law enforcement with the news and instead approached the state attorney general's office. On February 5, 2007, state investigators traveled from Jackson to the Pilgrim's Rest community in Noxubee. They drove past Gloria Jackson's old house and took a left. Less than a quarter mile later, they pulled up beside a small green clapboard cottage. Several agents covered the rear of the house, while two knocked on the front door. Justin Johnson answered. They confronted him with the DNA test results and placed him under arrest. He confessed to the murder and agreed to return with the investigators to the crime scene. At Brewer's old house, Johnson showed the investigators how he walked up to the bedroom window, quietly opened it, saw Brewer asleep, reached in and lifted Christine, and removed her from the house. He then described how he sexually assaulted her, strangled her, and threw her, still alive, into the creek. He said he had acted alone. The investigators then asked Johnson if he remembered committing any similar crimes. He did. It happened in Brooksville a few years before he murdered Christine Jackson. He remembered driving his car and parking near a pond. He described spotting Courtney Smith's house, opening the unlocked door, walking past a man sleeping on a couch, and entering the bedroom. He described abducting the little girl, assaulting her, killing her, and disposing of her body. He never bit either girl. Brooks was back in luck. 10 days later, swarms of friends and family, state and local officials, and reporters packed the Noxubee County courthouse. Satellite trucks parked on the surrounding streets. Out front, someone dressed as Smokey Bear handed out saplings as part of a campaign to reforest the county. Kennedy Brewer returned to the spot where he had once been condemned to die, surrounded by his new attorneys. Forrest Allgood sat off to the side, by himself, in the well of the courtroom. Peter Neufeld addressed the court at length about the case's many twists and turns, but the next day's Clarion Ledger headline summed it up best. Without DNA, he'd be dead. Once he'd been informed of the results from Ed Blake's lab, Special Prosecutor Ben Creekmore raised no objection to the defense motion to exonerate Brewer. At court that day, he apologized to Brewer and his family. "Nothing I say will give you back the time and loss." With that, the judge turned to Brewer. The most recent exchange between the two men had been 13 years earlier, when the same judge had set Brewer's execution date, following that with the words, "May God have mercy on your soul." This time the judge said simply, "You're hereby discharged. You are free to go." LaVon Brooks's exoneration followed a month later, on March 13th. Cumulatively, the two men spent over 30 years in prison. Though they had known one another before all of this, they never communicated in parchment. Until the very end, neither knew that the same man had committed the crimes for which they each had been convicted. 4 years later, on April 9th, 2012, Justin Johnson pleaded guilty to 2 counts of capital murder for killing Christine Jackson and Courtney Smith. He was sentenced to 2 consecutive life terms without the possibility of parole. Ed Blake's rigorous work had saved Kennedy Brewer's life. His insistence on testing the remaining biological material, he felt that as a professional matter, it just simply was something that had to be done, also ended up saving LaVon Brooks. There's the theory of how our criminal justice system should operate, and then, of course, there's the practice, he says. Cases looked at individually can teach us things. Whether they do teach us anything is the debate. The Kennedy Brewer case can teach things. You can't say, it's not logical to say, that simply because the situation got corrected, that shows the strength of our system. Blake's view is not widely shared, particularly by those who are best positioned to take stock, learn, and offer a sensible path forward. Forrest Allgood has said on numerous occasions that although the system failed in the Brooks and Brewer cases, it also worked. What he means, of course, is that all things considered, the net result was what the process aspired to in the first place, the identification and apprehension of the real perpetrator. In a 2008 letter to the editor defending his prosecutions, Allgood argued that the fact that Brooks and Brewer combined spent nearly 3 decades in prison for crimes that they didn't commit was nothing more than truth being the daughter of time. Allgood isn't alone in his thinking. The late Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia believed the same thing. In a 2006 opinion discussing the intersection of an inmate's claim of factual innocence and the death penalty, Scalia wrote that the possibility that someone will be punished mistakenly is a truism, not a revelation. For Scalia, Allgood, and many others, the moral hazards inherent in that position are worth the risk. But the risk is not an abstract one. It means people like LaVon Brooks and Kennedy Brewer must spend time in prison. For Brooks, 18 years, and for Brewer, 12, 5 on death row. Brooks was 32 when he was incarcerated, 50 when freed. Brewer was just 18 when he was arrested. He was 32 when he got out. The two men spent their time in one of the most notorious penitentiaries on the planet. They missed births and deaths, graduations and weddings. Both men missed their kids' entire childhoods. Shortly after his conviction, Brooks told the mother of his then-infant daughter, "Just go on with your life. Just go on with your life." Kennedy Brewer had a little boy at the time he was convicted. When Brewer was finally freed, his son, now a young man, drove his dad home from the courthouse. It's worth noting that Forrest Allgood still believes in Kennedy Brewer's guilt, and still seems to have a tough time stating definitively that LaVon Brooks is innocent. In a 2017 email interview, he wrote, "Just because Brooks's or Brewer's DNA wasn't found in the victim's vaginal vault doesn't mean they didn't participate in the kidnapping/killing. By the time Justin Johnson confessed, Allgood had been recused from Brewer's case, but was still the prosecutor in Brooks's. In the same 2017 email interview, he explained why he didn't retry Brooks. "I made the decision not to retry Brooks only after talking to Ashley. Of course, it was 20 years after the fact, and she was a young lady. She told me, 'Sometimes I know exactly what I saw, then at other times I'm not so sure. That's not proof beyond a reasonable doubt, and that's why I didn't retry Brooks.'" Brewer is another matter. "In short, they believed in DNA. I believed in my case," Allgood writes, referring to the courts and Brewer's attorneys. "The circumstances of the child's disappearance were powerful, and I would have retried Brewer had I been able to remain in the case." Brooks's and Brewer's incarcerations spanned the better part of Forrest Allgood's time in the district attorney's seat. When asked in a 2011 documentary to reflect on the cases, Allgood pondered for a moment and then said, "No one died." He was, of course, referring to the fact that neither Brooks nor Brewer was executed. But for a man who had claimed to be the voice, the shield, and the sword for victims of violent crime for his entire career, Allgood's comment was strikingly short-sighted. Two people died. Two little girls. And at least one of those deaths could have been prevented. In May 2008, Mississippi Governor Haley Barbour appointed Steve Simpson to head up the Mississippi Department of Public Safety. Privately, some of Haynes' critics in the state were optimistic about the appointment. The Brooks and Brewer exonerations prodded the legislature into finally budgeting money to hire a state medical examiner and staff, $500,000. Part of the money would come from the fee the state charged motorists who wanted NASCAR-themed license plates. Despite the funding, given the state's history with medical examiners, there was good reason to think that the most qualified candidates might be wary of the job. Simpson was a Republican. A perch at DPS made him a possible future opponent of popular Democratic Attorney General Jim Hood, one of Haynes' biggest public supporters. Perhaps most importantly, Simpson was from the Gulf Coast, where he had previously been a prosecutor and circuit court judge. The Gulf Coast was one of the few parts of the state Haynes never penetrated, likely because of geography. It's a 3-hour drive from Bay St. Louis to Jackson. That meant Simpson hadn't used Haynes when he was a prosecutor, and probably hadn't seen him very many times as a judge, if at all. Consequently, Simpson had little to lose in going after Haynes. And he may have had something to gain. It was an issue he could potentially leverage against Hood should he decide to challenge Hood for Attorney General. Simpson delivered, though at first reluctantly. On August 5, 2008, he removed Haynes from the list of doctors who could perform autopsies for Mississippi's prosecutors. Among Haynes' critics, there was hope that Simpson would also announce a review of the doctor's thousands of cases. Instead, flanked by Mississippi Lieutenant Governor Phil Bryant and several state legislators and county coroners, Simpson announced that his main priority was to hire a new state medical examiner, the first in 13 years. Until he could fill the position, the state would contract most of its autopsies to a private pathology firm in Nashville, Tennessee. The rest would be handled by a list of approved pathologists designated by Simpson's office. Simpson didn't mention Haynes by name in his opening statement, and during the question-and-answer period went out of his way to say that none of this was in reaction to the criticism of Haynes or to the Brooks and Brewer exonerations. Later, he was quoted in the Clarion Ledger thanking Haynes for his service. But it was obvious to anyone who had been paying attention what had just happened. On that list of designated pathologists, only Stephen Haynes' name had been removed. Prior to the announcement, Simpson had sent Haynes a letter informing him that his name had been removed and that he could no longer perform autopsies in the state lab. He was the only person to receive such a letter. After 20 years, thousands of court cases, and upward of 25,000 autopsies, Stephen Haynes had just been fired. Yet Simpson publicly insisted that this wasn't what he was doing. Haynes would no longer be doing autopsies for state prosecutors, Simpson said, but he has not been terminated. The next day, he invited Haynes to apply for the state medical examiner position, though Simpson surely knew that under state law, Haynes wasn't qualified to hold it. Still, there's no mistaking what had just happened. Prior to Simpson's announcement, Haynes had been doing about 80% of the state-ordered autopsies. After Simpson's announcement, he'd be doing none. And yet, Simpson's move still didn't bar Haynes from Mississippi's courtrooms. He would still be allowed to testify for the state in his backlogged cases, as well as any prior cases in which an appellate court might order a new trial. He could also continue to testify in civil cases, and, should he want to, for criminal defendants. 2 weeks later, the Clarion Ledger reported that Haynes still had yet to issue reports for 400 to 500 autopsies. His backlog was twice the number of annual autopsies recommended by the National Association of Medical Examiners. Haynes and West haven't been the only source of forensic controversy in the United States. The problems with expert testimony have manifested in scandals all over the country. In Oklahoma City, crime lab analyst Joyce Gilchrist had earned the name Black Magic for her uncanny ability to find damning forensic evidence to link a suspect to a crime scene. She sent 21 people to death row, 11 of whom were executed before she was exposed in 2001. One of the men she had helped convict was later exonerated by DNA evidence. A subsequent investigation showed that Gilchrist had provided false evidence in a number of cases. In West Virginia, crime lab analyst Fred Zane became a darling of the state's prosecutors with his ability to produce matches in difficult cases and then sell juries on those matches. Like Michael West, Zane won a reputation that soon landed him referrals from out of state. Zane was exposed when DNA testing cleared Glenn Woodall of a series of sexual assaults. It was the first ever DNA-based exoneration in the United States. Zane was later shown to have lied about his credentials and to have faked evidence in countless cases. A West Virginia Supreme Court report concluded that Zane may have caused the wrongful convictions of as many as 134 people. In 2005, the state of Tennessee found state medical examiner Charles Harlan guilty on 20 counts of misconduct that included incompetence and tampering with evidence. He was stripped of his position and his medical license. The state's chief witness against Harlan was Bruce Levy, who replaced Harlan as state medical examiner and whose Nashville-based company inherited the bulk of Haynes' work in Mississippi. Incredibly, Levy would later be arrested in Jackson, Mississippi on drug charges. He had allegedly received a package of marijuana while staying at a hotel. Levy was put into a diversion program for first-time offenders, and his record was expunged. He's now back doing pathology work and is a respected medical examiner. In the years since Haynes' firing, more crime lab and forensic scandals have erupted all over the country, including at some of the most prestigious labs in the world. Since 2015 alone, there have been crime lab controversies in Houston, Austin, Orlando, Santa Clara County, California, San Francisco, Broward County, Florida, three different state police labs in Oregon, a state police lab in New Jersey, and a state lab in Ohio. Some cities, states, and government agencies have reacted admirably, calling for immediate, thorough, and well-funded investigations to both uncover the extent of the damage and seek out and reverse wrongful convictions. In April 2017, for example, the state of Massachusetts threw out more than 21,000 drug convictions after it was revealed that a lab analyst had been faking results for years. Others have been far less forthright and transparent. Few have implemented the sorts of changes needed to minimize cognitive bias, to ensure that incentives for analysts are structured to reward neutral fact-finding, and to root out corruption. For the better part of 20 years, Hain performed approximately 80% of Mississippi's state autopsies and testified in a similar percentage of its homicide cases. In that sense, what happened in Mississippi may be the most wide-reaching scandal to date. Few states have encountered revelations that strike as forcefully at the very foundation of its criminal justice system. And few states' public officials have shown less concern or taken less action after having learned of the problem. In fact, part of the problem may be just how profound it really is. Even for a judge or prosecutor who never used Hain, to concede that it was a mistake to let him dominate the autopsy referrals all these years would be to acknowledge that the system to which they've dedicated their careers is profoundly and fundamentally flawed. Who would review all of those cases to see which may have been tainted? Who would be set free? Would every Hain case be retried, or only those in which his testimony was crucial to the outcome? What about all the civil cases? What about the cases in which his autopsy results cleared cops or jail guards of deaths in their custody? Who would bear the expense for all of these reviews? To admit to the full extent of the problem would also potentially open up the state to massive liability, likely in the hundreds of millions of dollars, possibly more, never mind the collateral damage to the state's justice system generally. Still, at least some officials have called for that. Ken Winter, the former director of the Mississippi Crime Lab and head of the state's Police Chiefs Association, said so in a 2013 Huffington Post article. "I've been telling Jim Hood for years that this calls for an investigation into Stephen Hayne and Michael West," Winter said. "At the very least, we need a bona fide cold case unit that looks for cases like this. And it needs to be done by people with some integrity, people who are willing to look for open murders, but who will also look for cases where an innocent person may have been convicted." But voices like Winter's have been rare, particularly when it comes to police and prosecutors. "This is a political problem, not a medical problem," says Vincent DiMaio, the renowned medical examiner and author of several forensic pathology textbooks. "The government needs to do the right thing, but doing the right thing could hurt political careers, subject people to lawsuits, and force people to admit to making mistakes. Governments are made up of people, and people don't like to put themselves in those positions." By 2010, Mississippi Supreme Court Justice Oliver Diaz had emerged as one of the most prominent critics of Hayne, and he did so from his perch on the state's highest court. In Jones v. State, he rejected Hayne's claim that the angle of bullet trajectory in a murder victim's body was consistent with being shot by someone across the street where police had found a beer can containing the defendant's DNA. As Diaz pointed out in his opinion, Haynes was not an expert in ballistics, and there were far too many variables for him to have reached that opinion. It wasn't the first time Hayne had offered such speculation. Diaz was the lone dissenter in that case. The talkative, proper Southern Justice Diaz came to the court from the Gulf Coast, where a large portion of the state's plaintiff's bar is headquartered. After his election in 2000, he took some loans from a Democratic operative to pay off the debts he had incurred responding to attack ads. There was nothing illegal in that. But once judges are elected, they're supposed to recuse themselves from any cases involving a party with whom they have a personal or financial interest. In a state as small as Mississippi, it can be difficult to discern where to draw that line. That also can make it easy to draw connections to make a judge appear corrupt. In 2003, Don Lampton, then a U.S. attorney, indicted Diaz on allegations that he had tried to influence the court in a libel case involving the father of the man who gave him the campaign loan. As it turns out, the vote in that case was unanimous, and there was no evidence that Diaz had exerted any influence with other justices. Diaz was acquitted of the charges in 2005. But 6 days later, Lampton indicted Diaz again, this time on charges of tax evasion. The following year, Diaz was acquitted of those charges, too. Lampton then filed a complaint against Diaz with the Mississippi Commission on Judicial Performance. That, too, was dismissed. The charges against Diaz fueled existing allegations that the Bush administration was running a politically motivated Department of Justice. They also came during the national backlash against trial lawyers. And in this instance, they may have also been personal. The man Diaz beat in the 2000 campaign was Don Lampton's mentor. The late prosecutor's crusade against Diaz would later serve as the inspiration for John Grisham's book, The Appeal. Diaz was up for re-election in 2008, even though he'd been twice acquitted by a jury and cleared by the Judicial Commission. He was still running as a justice who had been twice indicted. Fighting those charges also forced him to sit out a good portion of his term. The law and order group, the LEAA, pounced. They ran a ghastly TV ad accusing Diaz of voting in favor of two baby killers and a man who was later executed for beating a woman to death. All three allegations were gross distortions. One of the cases should sound familiar. "When a 6-month-old child was raped and murdered," the menacing voiceover sneered, "Supreme Court Justice Diaz was the only one voting for the child's killer." The ad was referring to Jeffrey Havard. The LEAA ad was condemned by a committee set up by the Mississippi Supreme Court to review judicial election procedures. Several television stations eventually pulled it off the air, although by then it had run statewide for at least a week. Diaz eventually lost the election by 16 points. His loss slowed any momentum that may have been building toward a proper review of Haynes' tenure in Mississippi. Diaz's last opinion was a dissent in a death penalty case. In it, he reflected on capital punishment and his own experience on the receiving end of the criminal justice system. "My unique life experiences have shown me, to a greater degree, I submit respectfully, than any other justice voting today, the potentially oppressive power of government prosecution," he wrote. "Innocent men can be, and have been, sentenced to die for crimes they did not commit. In 2008 alone, two men, both black, convicted of murders in Mississippi in the mid-1990s have been exonerated. One of these men, Kennedy Brewer, spent an astonishing 6 years on death row. Just as a cockroach scurrying across a kitchen floor at night invariably proves the presence of thousands unseen, these cases leave little room for doubt that innocent men, at unknown and terrible moments in our history, have gone unexonerated and been sent baselessly to their deaths." Each year, the various innocence projects around the country gather together to discuss their work, learn about developments within the field, and socialize with colleagues. The group also invites all the exonerees from the previous year to attend, with all expenses paid. LeVon Brooks and Kennedy Brewer received their invitations in 2008. It was a surreal moment for both men. The conference was in Santa Clara, California, and neither had ever been on an airplane. In fact, with the exception of West Alabama, which borders Noxubee County, neither had ever been outside the state of Mississippi. LeVon Brooks almost didn't make it. When Brooks returned home from prison, he had a difficult time tracking down his personal records, not an uncommon problem among exonerees who have spent years behind bars. Because the conference was just a couple of weeks after his release, Brooks hadn't had time to get a new photo ID. The Mississippi Department of Motor Vehicles refused to make an exception for him. Fortunately, American Airlines was more forgiving. When notified of his predicament, the airline sent gate agents to meet Brooks at the airport. He presented them his Parchman Penitentiary Identification Badge, now expired, and they welcomed him onto the plane. The two exonerees marveled at California. Neither had ever seen the ocean, so they gingerly waded into the Pacific, but not too far. They gazed in awe at the towering trees in Big Basin Redwood State Park. They toured an art museum with the Innocence Project's Peter Neufeld. They bought new clothes. Brewer bought mirrored sunglasses. Brooks sported jeans still lined with the crease from the store shelf. They looked at sushi, then opted for something else. They politely tried craft beer, but quickly returned to their old standby, Bud Light. At one point, they ran out of their favorite brand of tobacco dip and spent the better part of a morning hitting up convenience stores across Santa Clara until they found it. They also met Ed Blake, the man who helped set them free. The entire adventure took place in Carrie Mullis's backyard, just miles from where he had once pulled over along a stretch of Pacific Coast Highway to ponder the thoughts that, all these years later, ignited the chain of events that ultimately brought Brooks and Brewer to California. Outside the courts, Stephen Hayne began to face mounting criticism from others in his profession. In 2008, members of both the College of American Pathologists and the National Association of Medical Examiners investigated complaints against him. The Innocence Project of New York also filed a complaint with the Mississippi Board of Medical Licensure, requesting that the board revoke Haynes' license. Dwelia South, the new president of the Mississippi State Medical Association, told Reason magazine, "I don't know why Dr. Haynes is still a member of our organization. I'm going to try to get him booted. I can't believe he is allowed to take the stand and use our organization's name to boost his credentials. That isn't right. What he's doing is unethical and unprofessional. It's malpractice." There was more. The newspaper in Hattiesburg, the state's fourth largest city, called for a comprehensive review of the cases in which Haynes had testified, and Louisa Dixon, the former public safety commissioner and crime lab director, wrote a long op-ed in the Clarion Ledger criticizing Hain and explaining why the state's death investigation system needed both a state medical examiner with a full staff and a dramatic overhaul. One might think that after such criticism from such varied sources, not to mention the Brooks and Brewer exonerations, the state's prosecutors would be a bit chastened, and perhaps be reviewing their case files for other questionable testimony from Hain or West. Perhaps, as had happened in other jurisdictions, they'd even work with a group like the Innocence Project to help uncover other possible wrongful convictions. Not in Mississippi. In March 2008, the Mississippi Innocence Project and the Innocence Project of New York sent an open records request to every prosecutor in the state, asking for copies of reports of any autopsies Hain had done for that office at the state crime lab. The attorneys for the organization weren't demanding that prosecutors reopen these cases. They were only asking for the records so they could conduct a review themselves. The next day, Mississippi Prosecutors Association President Ben Creekmore, the same man who had apologized to Kennedy Brewer in the well of a Noxubee County courtroom, said he'd be advising all members of his organization to refuse the request. He told the Associated Press, "There are families all across the state of Mississippi who would be affected by the wholesale release of information related to the death of their loved ones." Taking advantage of Mississippi's stingy open records law, the state's prosecutors followed Creekmore's advice. The rejection letters poured in. None of the state's 22 district attorneys complied, and 16 sent letters denying the request. Most of the letters included boilerplate legalese about privacy, burdensomeness, and how their work product was exempt under the state's open records law. The latter, even if true, didn't bar them from turning over the reports. It only gave them the option to refuse. Like nearly all the other district attorneys, 12th Circuit D.A. John Mark Weathers, whose jurisdiction included Michael West's own Forest County, said he was unaware of any wrongful convictions in his circuit. However, he wrote, if the Innocence Project was aware of such a case, they should forward him the name of the victim, the name of the defendant, the date and place of the crime, the case number, and all other factual information, so his office could investigate. He missed the point entirely. The purpose of the request was to review old cases to find possible wrongful convictions. If the Innocence Project lawyers had already been aware of a wrongful conviction, they'd almost certainly already have the autopsy report. In 2010, 2 years after Weathers stated he was unaware of any wrongful convictions in his circuit, three men, Philip Bivens, Larry Ruffin, and Bobby Ray Dixon, were exonerated by DNA testing for a 1979 rape and murder in Forest County. The DNA matched a man who had committed a similar crime in the county 2 years earlier. Ruffin died in prison in 2002. Dixon was released on medical parole in August 2010, but died a month before he was exonerated. Only Bivens lived to see his name cleared. Of course, Weathers had no role in those cases, nor did Hain or West. And Weathers himself didn't oppose the DNA testing that cleared the three men. But that the exonerations came so soon after Weathers declared he knew of no such cases in his district only underscored how easily injustices could slip through the cracks. In February 2009, the National Academy of Sciences released a long-awaited report on the state of forensics in America's courtrooms. The report was a broad denunciation of many fields of forensics commonly thought to be reliable. But it was particularly critical of bite mark analysis. The report found that bite mark analysis is introduced in criminal trials without any meaningful scientific validation, determination of error rates, or reliability testing to explain the limits of the discipline. Analysts were too often provided with only a suspect and a few alternatives, which created the potential for large bias. Blind comparisons were rare, and once law enforcement officials got the match they wanted, they rarely turned to a second analyst for confirmation. The report's final paragraphs were its most critical. Despite the fact that practitioners felt that human skin could register and preserve enough detail from a bite to match it to someone's teeth, no scientific studies support this assessment. The report added that its authors found no evidence of an existing scientific basis for identifying an individual to the exclusion of all others. The NAS report was widely expected to be a watershed event in forensics, but those predictions underestimated the intransigence of the status quo. Prosecutors continued to use and defend bite mark evidence around the country. In the years since the NAS report, more reports from the scientific community have criticized bite mark evidence with increasingly strong language. In February 2016, the Texas Forensic Science Commission, which was formed after revelations that the state had executed an innocent man based on bad arson science, recommended a moratorium on bite mark evidence. And in September 2016, the President's Council of Advisors on Science and Technology, PCAST, found not only no scientific research to support bite mark comparison, but also found the prospects of developing bite mark analysis into a scientifically valid method to be low. As of this writing, no court in America has upheld a challenge to the validity of bite mark evidence. Every defendant who has tried has lost. While these reports have aimed their heaviest criticism at bite mark analysts, they've generally been critical of all the pattern-matching disciplines. The law enforcement community hasn't taken the criticism well. After the PCAST report was published, U.S. Attorney General Loretta Lynch dismissed it out of hand, and the Justice Department released a statement declaring that it had no intention of implementing the group's recommendations. This put President Barack Obama in an interesting position. His Council of Science advisors had strongly recommended reforms that his Attorney General had just disavowed. The following December, Obama touted the PCAST report in an article for the Harvard Law Review about his administration's successes in criminal justice reform. What the article didn't mention, when it mattered most, Obama had sided with Lynch. The PCAST recommendations were never implemented at the DOJ. This was particularly unfortunate because although the FBI crime lab has a reputation as one of the most elite labs in the world, the agency has its own troubled history with bad forensics. Only recently, the FBI admitted that its hair fiber analysts had been overstating their findings in courtrooms for two decades and over thousands of cases. To make matters worse, those analysts had trained hundreds of analysts at state and local crime labs across the country. Even after the FBI admitted its mistake, federal prosecutors did only the bare minimum to notify defendants whose convictions may have been affected by the tainted testimony. Prior to that, the lab admitted that it had been wrong about bullet analysis. For years, the agency claimed that every batch of manufactured ammunition has a unique chemical signature. Therefore, if a bullet found at a crime scene matched the signature of bullets found in a suspect's home, the bullets could only have come from the same box. The theory was bogus. The FBI had also botched its investigation of the anthrax attacks in 2001, leading to the wrongful arrest and persecution of Stephen Hatfill, and had mistakenly matched a partial fingerprint taken from the 2004 Madrid train bombings to Oregon attorney Brandon Mayfield. Given all of that history, Lynch's assertion that the DOJ didn't need to implement the PCAST reforms because the FBI had internal procedures to assure it was using good science wasn't particularly reassuring. Recent investigations, exonerations, and studies have also revealed scientific shortcomings in ballistics comparison, tire tread analysis, shoe print analysis, handwriting analysis, and even fingerprint matching. Shaken baby syndrome has come under scrutiny. Drug field test kits have been shown to have scandalously high rates of false positives, as have drug-sniffing dogs and dogs used to identify suspects based on scents taken from clothes or from the air. One study published in 2013 found that, incredibly, crime lab analysts in many states are paid per conviction. Many labs are funded partially or even entirely by fees assessed to defendants, but only upon conviction. No conviction means no fee, and no fees mean less funding. In North Carolina, judges assessed defendants a $600 fee upon conviction to fund state and local crime labs. In Kansas, defendants were charged $400 for each conviction that required the use of the crime lab. Washington charged $100. In all, the study found that at least 17 states, including Mississippi, at least partially funded their crime labs with money assessed upon conviction. Needless to say, funding crime labs with money assessed only after convictions is a dangerous way to get sober, objective analysis. All of these could be classified as mistakes involving analysts who were well-meaning but mistaken. There's then an entire other class of scandals involving analysts who faked their credentials, dry-labbed, a euphemism for faked, test results, or otherwise knowingly deceived jurors. A 2010 investigation of the North Carolina State Crime Lab revealed analysts' year-end reviews were conducted by prosecutors who evaluated them on their ability to help win convictions. Stephen Hain may have been fired, but he was far from finished. The Innocence Project's complaint against Hain with the state's Board of Medical Licensure was unsuccessful. The board said it was concerned that Hain was performing too many autopsies, but it declined to take any action against him. The College of American Pathologists sealed its own investigation into Hain. The entire process was conducted in secret. When it was over, the organization essentially punted. The group did send Hain a letter of concern about the volume of autopsies he had been doing, but the ethics committee ultimately concluded that it lacked sufficient evidence on which to base a finding that you are deficient in moral character or professional competence or guilty of professional misconduct, and therefore would take no further action. Hain's attorney, Dale Danks, told the Clarion Ledger that the group had absolved his client of wild accusations. The National Association of Medical Examiners, NAME, investigation went a little differently. According to a source involved in the investigation, Hain was given a choice: either stand for an ethics inquiry or resign from the group. He chose to resign. According to Hain, after a complaint was filed with the group, he demanded to know who filed it. NAME refused to tell him, so he resigned. Perhaps emboldened by these professional organizations' decisions not to discipline him, Hain and Mississippi's prosecutors and coroners began to fight back. In April 2009, Hain filed a defamation lawsuit against the Innocence Project of New York and two of its attorneys. After a contentious deposition in that suit in 2012, Hain accepted a settlement that was less than it would have cost to litigate the case. The Innocence Project of New York didn't retract its accusations against Hain, but cited the contract with its insurer. Danks again claimed vindication for his client, and this time said that Hain deserves credit for helping exonerate Brooks and Brewer because Hain had preserved the DNA from those cases. That same year, Yazoo County Coroner Ricky Shivers asked Mississippi Attorney General Jim Hood to issue an opinion about an antiquated state statute that allowed adjoining counties to form their own districts for the purpose of administering autopsies. The old law was intended to help poorer counties pool resources to conduct murder investigations. Shivers wanted to use the law to allow adjoining counties to create such districts for the purpose of hiring their own medical examiner. Shivers later admitted, boasted even, that it was all an attempt to circumvent Steve Simpson and bring back Stephen Hain. On June 26th, Hood's office issued an answer: go for it. Just days after Hood's office released that opinion, Hain began faxing copies of the opinion to sympathetic coroners around Mississippi. He followed up with a packet of information, including a copy of the legal forms necessary to form the new independent districts. Shivers said in an interview with Reason that 11 different coroners explicitly told him they had already taken steps to create renegade districts solely so they could rehire Hain, and that around 20 others indicated that they planned to do the same. "I've already done the paperwork for Yazoo County," he said, "and it's already been approved by my board of supervisors." DPS Commissioner Simpson was livid at Hood for issuing the opinion. "The ruling is contradictory to a 1992 Attorney General's opinion that says medical